This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of our guests on Fresh Air are writers. Today we're going to talk about books and the publishing industry with three veteran editors. Jonathan Galassi is vice president and executive editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Among the authors he's worked with are Scott Turow, Tom Wolfe, Susan Sontag, and Alice McDermott. Galassi has a new collection of his own poetry called North Street. Robert Loomis is executive editor and vice president of Random House, where he's worked since the late 1950s. He has edited William Styron, Woody Allen, Seymour Hersh, Maya Angelou, and Edmund Morris. Michael Korda has been editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster's trade division since 1968. He's edited books by Graham Greene, Jackie Collins, Harold Robbins, Mary Higgins Clark, and Presidents Nixon and Reagan. Korda has also written several bestsellers. His latest book is a memoir about his life in publishing called Another Life. I asked each editor to name a current or recent book they edited that has done well and what they feel its success says about the state of publishing. Jonathan Galassi mentioned the new Seamus Heaney translation of the epic poem Beowulf, which is believed to date back to the 8th century. I asked him how it managed to become a bestseller.
Well, a lot of things happened. It won the Whitbread Book of the Year prize in England. It got ecstatic reviews. Seamus Heaney himself is a very highly regarded and loved poet who won the Nobel Prize. It's had a lot of ribbons pinned on it. But I think that it's not so exceptional, actually, Terry. I think that if you look at what's published and what breaks into the front of notice, very, very regularly there are books of real literary merit that do find big readerships. It's wonderful. It's I love it. It's exciting. But I don't think it's totally a fluke.
What are the other examples you're thinking of?
Well, a few years ago we had Birthday Letters by Ted Hughes, which was... his poems about his marriage to Sylvia Plath. That was another poetry book that was also, it was number 5, I think, on the Times bestseller list. So that's another book in this particular category.
Bob Loomis, executive editor and vice president of Random House. What's a current or recent book that you've had on the bestseller list, and what does that say to you about the state of reading and publishing?
Well, you asked Jonathan about a separate book, and I'd like to mention Michael Korda's book, which we did, his autobiography in publishing, which was a marvelous book, and we had so much fun with it because it was about our business and people really related to it. But more recently, a book called Dutch, which is by Edmund Morris, and it was a biography of Ronald Reagan, which stirred up more storm and more copy than any book I've ever been involved with. The historians, many of them took it to task because Edmund created a character who was a witness throughout Reagan's life, even though he did not impinge on his life.
It's a fictional character he created.
A fictional character. And the political people who felt that Edmund had had access to Reagan and his White House that no one else had, and he did not, therefore, delve very deeply into things like Iran-Contra. But the book really is a piece of literature, and it's being read that way now. We're going to bring it out in the Modern Library this next season. It's an absolutely superb, stunning book, and I think Edmund's a genius.
This must have been a tough book for you, though, because how many years was it in the making?
Maybe 14 years.
Okay, so that's a long time to wait for a book, number one. And number two, I think it was supposed to be a much more conventional biography. And then years down the line after he had started the book, Edmund Morris decided to make it a kind of mixture of fiction and biography by adding this fictional observer. What were your thoughts when he wanted to do that? Did you think, this is going to be a real problem?
I did at first. And then I saw how he was doing it, and I knew it would cause problems, but the fact is that he was able, by this method, to bring Reagan to life in a way no one else had. None of the other biographies really got at him as a person, it seemed to me, and understood him the way Edmund did. And I think without that other viewpoint, he could not have lived in the times that the way he did. He would have been simply regurgitating what other people saw and wrote and said, and he would be kind of a artistic a rearranger. But this way he was able to really recast and to recreate Reagan's life. And as long as he kept to the absolute documented truth about Reagan himself and all of the historical people around him, I think that he did no injustice to biography. But it is changing now. There's a book coming out in England now, which is actually an autobiography of a famous person, but not written by him. And this sort of thing is going to shake up, I think, conventional biography a bit, and I think it needed it.
Michael Korter, editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster. What's a current or recent book you've had on the bestseller list, and what does that say to you about the state of publishing and reading?
I guess it would be Mary Higgins Clark's new novel, which seems to me to suggest that no matter what you do, people continue to read the same books that they've always liked reading. I absolutely agree that a book like Beowulf will come along every once in a while, and that there's a tremendous market for that kind of serious literature if it's tapped in the right way. But the truth of the matter is, if you go back and look at the bestseller list in time, people were reading pretty much the same kind of books in the 1930s and 1940s as they're reading today, and pretty much the same kind of books and authors were hitting the list.
I want to ask you where you think we are in the memoir craze, and I want to start by reading an excerpt of a book jacket for a recent memoir. I'm not even going to mention the title because I don't want to... It's not like I'm trying to say anything good or bad about this particular book, but it just seems to me a lot of memoirs... The book jacket blurbs read more like hospital case studies than literature. Okay, this book tells the story of a wife's search for independence and identity while living in the shadow of her husband's battle with anorexia. And there's so many memoirs now where just like the whole subject seems to be about the person's dysfunction or their sexual abuse or, you know, their weight disorder or medical disorder or something along those lines. How do you explain that?
Well, I'm sort of disqualified from doing this because I've written my memoirs three times, dividing my life up into different segments, and I expect to go on writing my memoirs until I'm dead. But that too, it seems to me, fits into an old popular mode of American book publishing. I mean, I can remember reading teary memoirs. 20, 30 years ago. So there's an enormous curiosity out there among Americans. This exists hardly at all in the rest of the world, to know about people's lives and to come away from the book both with a sense of spiritual hope that person has succeeded in overcoming this or that demon, and a sense that however miserable it is, your life is better than theirs.
There's also... a deeper candor here. There's a feeling today that almost anything goes. And if you will remember back, and perhaps you can't, the magazines, the True Confession magazines, they had an enormous popularity, particularly among women. And as a matter of fact, many of the descriptions you just read probably apply to books by women about very, very personal crises, problems, and so forth. And these have always had an appeal, and now they have. It's just sort of turned into a genre, which many, many people who wouldn't have written a book, frankly, can come along and feel that they can confess something awful that's happened to themselves and find a market for it. And if they can write well enough, they probably can find a market.
Let me read you something from, this is from a new novel by Francine Prose called Blue Angel. And her character is a novelist who hasn't written a novel in a long time. And he's also an English professor. And he's meeting with his editor, and the editor's trying to talk him out of finishing his novel and have him do a memoir instead. And the editor says, "Have you considered a memoir? You don't need me to tell you that's what's selling these days. It has to have the juicy gleam, the bloody smell of the truth. And half the people writing them, well, nothing ever happened to them. Maybe mom got drunk once or twice, smacked them around a little. But you, my friend, you watched your father incinerate himself on national TV. Writers with childhoods not half so dysfunctional as yours are turning them into gold mines." Does that ring true to you?
Just makes me grit my teeth.
I think that there has been a kind of vogue for memoirs, literary memoirs, or quasi-literary memoirs in the last 10 years. And it's still continuing. Actually, Michael's company has the current fave is the Dave Eggers book.
Yes.
But I think it feels sort of played out now mm-hmm. to me, mm-hmm. that particular vein. It feels like surfeit to me.
Let me confess something. You know, back in, I guess it was the late 80s, early 90s, I really thought that the memoir was like the most exciting literary form of the moment. This was the era of Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life and John Updike's memoir, Self-Consciousness. And then more and more people without those, you know, kind of literary gifts starting writing memoirs, and they seem to get just more mundane and more about the dysfunction than the writing and the perception. And I started to feel partly responsible for the memoir craze as one of the many interviewers who tends to do interviews with people who have a personal story to tell, because it's a very fulfilling type of interview. And I started to feel like I was partly responsible as an interviewer for driving this craze that was starting to head in the wrong direction.
Hmm. Actually, I'm sort of in favor of it. I wouldn't go so far, Terry, as to say that I think that everybody should write a memoir, because that's going to make far more books than we can publish or read. But on the whole, I can't think of anything less harmful as a human activity than sitting down to write a memoir. And even the worst memoir is usually much more readable than a bad, illiterate, or amateur novel. It has to be said that when people are writing about their own life, even if they're only semi-literate, they write a lot better than when they're trying to write poetry or fiction. So I'm rather cheerful about memoirs, actually. And I read a lot of them. I actually go to the Madison Avenue bookshop and sift through them and come away with bags full of other people's memoirs to read.
Is that novel quoting you, Michael, that she just read?
I don't think so.
Oh, it sounds like you.
My guests are three veteran book editors, Jonathan Galassi, Michael Corder, and Robert Loomis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the publishing industry. My guest is Jonathan Galassi, Vice President and Executive Editor at Frost, Rouse & Giroux, Bob Loomis, Executive Editor and Vice President of Random House, and Michael Corder, Editor-in-Chief for Simon & Schuster. What's the way in which you think the publishing industry has changed most, say, in the past decade?
Well, one thing that's happened recently in terms of the selling of books that I find very exciting is the availability of books through the multiplicity of avenues of access to books. The internet is one of them, and we're now doing 10% of our business on the internet. And not to beat this Beowulf drum too much, but last week we sold 3,000 copies of that book through one account alone on the internet, and a lot of those sales are added sales. I think internet is very good for our kind of publishing. Some of the books that we publish wouldn't necessarily be available in a lot of bookstores, including superstores, and so people who know what they want can find those books very expeditiously on the net, and that's a big change in publishing. Another change is the fact that very soon books won't really go out of print. They'll be available because the technology exists now to print very small quantities of books. So all of a sudden, many distribution problems are being solved. Books are really universally available now in a way they haven't been, and that is really revolutionary.
Michael Corder, what do you think has changed most in the past decade in the publishing industry?
Well, I think the thing that's changed the most is that publishing houses were formerly relatively small. Everybody in the house tended to be on one or at the most two floors and knew each other by name and by face. And the editors were regarded as a group of people who had to be cosseted, protected from the realities of the world, and who were essentially individual entrepreneurs operating within a publishing house. That's changed very considerably. Publishing has become a much bigger business. Most publishing houses are now so huge that you can't know or remember the names of almost anybody. And the editor has sort of descended rapidly down the totem pole, his place having, or her place having been taken by merchandisers, by planners, by financial executives, by marketers of one kind or another. That's a huge change, and it's difficult as yet to assess whether that's good or bad for the business or good or bad for writers. I think it's probably in some respects bad for writers. I think writers had a better time of it when the editors had more leeway, had more capacity for making independent decisions, and when they could more easily steer the organization up around a single book quickly and personally. That's now a very ponderous process in most publishing houses.
Well, Bob Loomis, you're executive editor at Random House, which is a huge part of a huge company. To give our listeners a sense of how huge, Random House now includes Random House, Times Books, Villard, Knopf, Crown, Vintage, Pantheon, Shock and Ballantine, Ivy, Modern Library, Bantam, Doubleday, Dell, Delacorte, Anchor, Dial, and Clarkson Potter Presses. I mean, this is all under the banner of Bertelsmann, the German company.
Could you send me a copy of that list?
That's right. I mean, can you even remember all of that? And so anyways, all these companies are now owned by the German company, Bertelsmann. It's just so confusing. So Bob Loomis, as executive editor at Random House, do you feel that a lot of editorial decisions are now in the hand of other corporate decision makers in marketing and publicity?
No, it isn't that clear cut. To save ourselves, we try to keep all of these companies that you named separate in some way.
Mm-hmm.
They're editorially separate. They usually have a separate sales force, a separate advertising company, a separate publicity, even separate production, so that we operate within the larger company as an independent, more or less independent unit. Obviously, the money is another problem I should have mentioned. That is a big difference in this business. Money does rule, and it never did in the same way before because the risks weren't so great. To buy a book now, we often pay far more than it earns back. And so part of our profit that we make has to go towards making up that loss. A few big books can save you, but it's pretty hard just to buy big books. And all of us here like big books, of course, because they're exciting, but we also like what they call a mid-list book. Those are almost all my personal favorites. And they are harder in a way to publish because they are up against the financial kind of big boys and the financial budgets and the attention that's paid and the attention the stores pay, particularly the chains, so that you feel as though you're a stepchild sometimes. At least I do. But we do try to keep our individual identity. And within that group you read, all of those companies are doing variously well. I mean, it's not a homogenous thing at all. And I think as long as we do well, we're pretty much let alone. Don't you find that, Michael?
I think that's an optimistic view.
Okay.
I hope that will be the case.
I hope it will be.
I am very doubtful. I mean, I have, first of all, until some miracle comes along, and maybe the e-book is going to be it, or maybe the flowering of, as Jonathan says, of internet book publishing will be it, or maybe it'll be some combination of those two things. What I see are publishing houses that are becoming huge with enormous support staffs, enormous marketing staffs, a vast amount of bureaucracy and paperwork, all of it very expensive. And it remains to be demonstrated that the editors, whoever their imprint may be within these structures, can actually produce, and that the American book business can actually sell enough copies to support these large animals. In short, I feel about them a little bit the way that an intelligent person might have felt about the dinosaur had he gone back in time and looked at the dinosaurs, which is, yeah, they look terrific. They're very exciting. They're big. In their own way, they're efficient. But can the landscape, in fact, support an awful lot of these large animals that eat that much over a various over a long period of time? And I'm not sure that that particular point has been answered. And if it's answered negatively, there will be something like a publishing catastrophe, because the actual sales of books, the number of books that are being sold, is not so much larger than it was, if indeed it is any larger, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And yet the companies doing it are twice the size, three times the size, 10 times the size, and with vastly larger and more expensive staffs.
We'll continue this discussion on the second half of the show with book editors Michael Korter, Robert Loomis, and Jonathan Galassi. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's continue our discussion about the publishing industry. My guests are three veteran editors: Jonathan Galassi, vice president and executive editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux; Robert Loomis, executive editor and vice president of Random House; and Michael Korter, editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster. When we left off, we were talking about the impact of corporate mergers and takeovers on the publishing industry. I asked Jonathan Galassi to describe how that pertains to his company, Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
We, until about 5 years ago, Farrar, Straus was one of the last of the small publishers that Michael was talking about, sort of valiantly struggling on in the with all the behemoths around us. But we, 5 years ago, we became part of the Holzbrink Group, which is another large German company with a more modest American presence than the two that my friends here work for. So far, I found that being part of a group has the benefits of that have far outweighed the difficulties. We have more freedom. We have more access to cash, et cetera. So we're in better shape now than we were 5 years ago, I think. Now, I understand the reservations that Michael and Bob have about the way the business goes, and you never know how it goes. But I think that the fact is that publishing in America has come down to five or six of these big behemoths, and part of it is because of the financial pressure that the revolution of rising expectation among authors has created in the publishing business. That's probably the biggest change in the past 30 years, wouldn't you two say?
Wait, what do you mean by the revolution of rising expectations of authors?
Well, I think when I started out in publishing about 25 years ago, the amounts of money were much more modest, much more reasonable, even for the big authors. Mm-hmm. They weren't expecting to be paid every penny and then some of what they were going to earn on a book at the moment they signed the contract, and it wasn't even written. And now that's very often the case. And I think that that pressure has it's like a wrestling match. All of a sudden, the author through the publisher, and all of a sudden, it used to be maybe the other way around. It used to seem much more collegial than that. It often doesn't feel that way now.
Well, I think what you're saying relates to what Bob Loomis had said, that you know that there's pressure for really big advances to writers, and a lot of those books don't earn out the advance. They don't make as much money as the publisher has paid the author for the book. So what's behind that pressure now to give the really big advance?
We've not mentioned one thing, which is we take for granted, which is the auction. That didn't exist before. Now we have an auction for almost any book. Any little outline that comes in is sent to five other houses. And somewhere along the line, some publisher is going to feel overly excited or have a special pet feeling for it or feel that they can do better with it. And so you will sell it it will go for a higher price than it would otherwise because there's this competition. And we have to buy books. If we don't buy books, we don't have anything to sell. So we're in these auctions all the time, and it's like candy with a baby. We all make mistakes. We all get overexcited, and we go ahead and do this. The proof of why that the money on that end has grown so much, look at the number of agents that exist now compared to, say, 15 years ago. You could look in Literary Marketplace, and there'd be, you know, 5 or 6 pages of agents. I don't know how many there are now, 25 or 50, because that end of the business, selling the book up front, is fairly lucrative with a relatively low overhead. And if you can get a few good authors, you can do pretty well. So they have proliferated at pretty much at our expense. Now, that's the marketplace. We can't really say that shouldn't happen because it does happen. But it's a situation which is a very, very difficult to deal with.
I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you all for talking with us about publishing.
It's our pleasure.
Jonathan Galassi is Vice President and Executive Editor of Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Robert Loomis is Executive Editor and Vice President of Random House. And Michael Korda is Editor-in-Chief of Simon & Schuster. Coming up, we meet one of Bob Loomis's authors, Stacy Schiff. Her biography of Vladimir Nabokov's wife, Vera, won a Pulitzer Prize this year. This is Fresh Air.